Is here this morning. I'm Representative Passeridge. The chair has asked us to begin the meeting for the record. He is tied up on other legislative business, as well as Representative Johnson and Senator Winters. We are continuing on with our hearing on the Secretary of State's office. Rick Olson is here from Legislative Fiscal Office. Rick, you want to let us know where we're at right now?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, yesterday we had begun a public hearing on Senate Bill 5543, Secretary of State budget. We had listened to the agency overview by Secretary Bradbury and had begun into the audits division, and I believe Secretary Bradbury wants to make a few comments on some material that he's handed out and then follow up on a few audit division items, and then we'll continue down the agenda from there.
Thanks, Rick. Mr. Secretary of State.
Thank you, welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Basically, what we wanted to start today with was this subcommittee had made some requests for some information from Kathy Polino, the head of the Audit Division. And I just wanted, before she started, I just wanted to point out that we handed out a news story today about the online blue book, which is something that we've now started to do, is put the entire blue book online, and then the published version will be available the third week in March. So just wanted you to see that and then turn it over to Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary of State. I've used your online service. It is very, very helpful. Morning, Kathy.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kathy Polino, Director of the Audits Division. I was asked to come back today and bring two of our reports, and they should be there before you. One of the reports that we were asked to bring was our informational report on K through 12 expenditures. And in this report, if I can just have you turn to page 2, basically shows the what Oregon spends per student in various expenditure categories. You can see how we also compare to the national average. And the chart table 1 on page 2 shows expenditures that are instructional expenditures. On page 3, table 2 shows the support services expenditures. One of the things we're doing is digging into some of those expenditure categories that appeared to be a little bit higher than the national average that kind of stuck out for us, mostly in the support services area. So that's kind of the second phase of the audit that we talked about yesterday that we are now digging into. And just for your information, there's some tables in the very back of the report starting on page 12 that show those same expenditures by school district, if you're interested, and then also on our website, there are the figures very similar to pages 2 and 3 for each school district. The volume is so much that we have that just on our website if anybody's interested in seeing their own particular school district and where their expenditures compare to their peers. So that is one of those reports.
Okay.
The other report I was asked to bring is a report on our fraud, waste, and abuse hotline. This report basically shows the activities from inception in 1995 to today. It shows number of calls over time, what types of agencies the calls are about, the origin, whether it's a state employee or a citizen that's calling in, the subject matter, and on page 4, the disposition of the calls and then how we referred those. And then at the very back, starting on page 5, there's a table that shows hotline calls that actually resulted in audit work and what the results of those audits were. So all that information is here in this report. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Just a question about how you can – I wasn't in on this particular – I was watching part of the time in my office, and then we had a subcommittee chairs meeting with the speaker for the House side subcommittee chairs. When you do your Secretary of State's audits in terms of – I view these more as management audits than necessarily financial audits, which is how you view them. Like I'm just looking at your Oregon spent more or less than the U.S. average on your K-12. I see where you're using apparently is a National Public Education Financial Survey. Do you go out and look at other sources, like just on salaries alone? We looked at the NEA stuff, the National Education Association stuff. during this last year, Oregon's teachers were the 13th highest paid in the country, according to the NEA information. Yet now we're saying they're paid $352 less. So I'm wondering how you determine what your means of comparison is going to be in terms of doing a man, because, I mean, to use one particular source, to me, doesn't seem an equitable way to do it, and since your Secretary of State's audits get quoted all over the place, I guess that is a concern of mine based upon what data you use rather than using a compilation of data that's available. I also know you have limited resource ability to do some of those comparisons, but it does tend to give a skewed picture to some degree should you use one source.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to point one thing out about these charts. There are some of the salaries built into the instructional side, and there are some of the salaries that are in the support services side. And you'll notice that they're a little bit different if you look at both of these.
Okay.
These reports are based on the actual financial statements, so actual dollars that are spent. We looked around and found that these are the best sources of information, which is the actual expenditures based on these categories. We felt these were the best comparators, and I don't know if the information you were looking at had both salaries and benefits included.
Yes, it did.
And
so
you'll see here that for the salaries, if you look just in the instructions, we are less, but then we are also significantly more on the benefit side. So you need to kind of look at both of those together.
But still, overall, we'd be less. I mean, we'd be less than a national
for
average.
For instructional spending.
Right.
Administrative spending is on the other side.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Well, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
You got it.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I saw this report earlier, the one on kindergarten, or K through 12. How much resources were devoted to this in terms of, I can imagine any time you tried to review the practices of 198 school districts, what was the approach to this, actually, in terms of resources? Because to actually have an accurate review, you'd have to devote quite a bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Evelyn, that's a great question. What's very nice about this is that our office receives from school districts already the financial statements, and so the information was there. This particular information was already available electronically at the Department of Education, and we were able to download the entire amount and then do some verification back to the financial statements, and that didn't take very long for us. So our resources to compile this was a matter of receiving the download, verifying the data against the financial statements, which are audited by CPA firms, and then doing our own analysis from there. So I don't have with me how many hours we devoted to this, but we actually put this audit out in a pretty quick time period. So I could get that for you if you'd be interested.
The responsive, Senator?
That's responsive. Thank you. Also, I have a question in terms of some of them vary quite widely in terms of on instruction. And I think the one item that you've included in non-instruction specifically is food services. And I'm trying to figure out exactly why they vary so much, and I guess maybe if you could provide me more documentation of, because I would assume if you provided any food service at all that you'd be at least in several percentage points, whether it was contracted or whether it was in-house. It would be at least several percentage points, and there are a few that are relatively high percentages for others, and it's kind of hard to figure out what that would be that fit into the category of other.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, the difficult thing about this is that at this point we don't have the whys, and what we're hoping to do is to provide the information so that the whys can be asked, because really this type of information wasn't available to school board members. They didn't know how they compared to their peers. It wasn't available to legislators so that you knew how you compared to the national average and where some of those anomalies might take place. And so we don't have the whys yet. There are, from our understanding so far, is there are some very valid reasons why there are differences could be because they have to travel long distances to ship food. It could be difference between contracting or providing it themselves. So there's lots of differences out there. We don't have the whys, but we have the information so you can start asking the whys.
Let's see. Representative Patrick and Senator Winters.
I also just a question to get back to us on. I'm sorry I missed the presentation yesterday, but I am interested in the audits division specifically and the management audits that you're asked to do. I'm interested in really the staff training that's occurred or the staff experience, because part of my issue, I guess, with the audits, especially management audits in Secretary of State's offices, I don't know if you particularly have the expertise in the particular areas, because you're not looking at those areas on a regular basis with kind of national experts and people like that. I think it's a fast and dirty way to do management audits that we do, but I don't think necessarily it's best practices, but I can't say that because I'm not sure what kind of training your personnel have and what abilities you have. And that's kind of one of the first rules of audit, according to the good chair, and he and I have discussed this in other areas, is your staff qualified and have the expertise? And I don't know if you were at a, what is it, big 6, 3, 4, whatever it is now.
Whatever it's down to today.
A national, a national management auditing firm or one of the spin-outs, if they would even allow you, the staff that you have, to do with particular types of auditing you have. Can you maybe speak to that a little bit, or we can talk maybe a little bit about that offline, either way. That's just it's not a criticism of your office. It's just it's a criticism of the audit system generally as we do it. I mean, LFO doesn't have the experience either to do a lot of the management kind of auditing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, one of the things that we feel we bring to the table is an independent look at operations and staff that are trained in what are called management controls. How do you set up good management controls in an organization? And one of the observations we've had over the years as far as state government is that we have a lot of managers who maybe were caseworkers and kind of grew up in the system and are now managers that know the programs but don't necessarily know management controls. And that's where we feel we're providing the benefit, is walking them through what does a good management process look like. Do you have a good solid mission? Do you have policies to carry out your mission? Do you have an information system that gives you the information you need to manage your program? That's what we teach our staff to look for. And hopefully by going in and asking certain kinds of questions, we can help in the process for management audits. But that's where we focus our training, is on the how do you set up a good management system, and hope to bring that to the table.
But Thank you very much, Kathy. And I think this is an issue that I'd like to go ahead and have an opportunity to have Kathy perhaps meet with Rob and staff relative to the training and expertise that's necessary in order to commence with a management and a programmatic audit as opposed to the financial audit. So we'll return to that if we could, and let's do that and then get back and make a report to the full committee. Representative Patrick is agreeing to that, and Rick Olson has nothing better to do with his time, I'm sure. Senator Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to follow up on a comment of one of the questions that Senator Devlin had with respect to what may be one of the variables why there was a discrepancy in costs on the paid side. Probably one of the biggest ones, including the travel of how you bring your goods in, but more so it would be your menu, because your menu would determine whether or not you're high in protein, which was on the meat side, would cost you a lot more if you're on the veggie side of the aisle. But your menu would probably pay the most dramatic part in the variable in cost. This is just from a restaurateur who
Mr. Chairman,
who has to look at those kinds of costs.
Mr. Chairman, question to Senator Winters.
Please, Senator Winters.
That the cost of operating the lounge upstairs should be going down is...
Well, you know,
the absence of meat on the.
You actually no, because what you're finding is that it's also seasonal. In certain times of the year, your fruits and vegetables that have to be imported from someplace else cost you more if you follow the market. So a lot of it is really market driven. The other piece of it is whether or not you're buying generic or whether you're buying or whether you're buying beef, you know, and whether it's locally or organic. So all of those are variable components in the purchasing part of it. So it is not necessarily because you're eating vegetables that it means that it's lower in cost. If you look at the market, sometimes you go into those exclusively boutiques, it costs you a lot more than if you went down and had your nice beef burger.
I'd be happy to share with Representative Devlin or Senator Devlin a management analysis that our company had done, because we serve a substantial amount of meals as to menu trends and in regard to which menus we're going to serve during which seasons in order to keep costs lower. So if you'd like to do that, and we always try and eat beef.
And for those who do not know, you know, where he's pointing to beef, because there are certain parts of our ag community, that's particularly over in eastern and central Oregon, where we do have longhorn. Most people do not know that in this state, but there are longhorn that exists in Oregon. And it's very, very lean. In fact, there was a study that was done, I believe, by OSU, that it's comparable to the, if you eat, counting your calories to chicken. Just to put that on.
Thank you. Little
did you guys
I want you to know that 500,000 cows in southeastern Oregon, thank you very much. Let's continue on, Kathy. I'm not sure where you're at in the overall presentation, but I'll catch up with you here.
Mr. Chair, I'm done.
Okay.
Unless we have more questions.
Further questions of Kathy. Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Let's see. We have Gene Strait, Director of Business Services Division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jean Strait, and I'm the Director of the Business Services Division, and I'm going to give you a brief description of the Business Services Division and the Personnel Resources Division's budget. Business Services Division provides central business functions for the entire agency. These services include accounting, budgeting, deposit, purchasing, and contracting. The division's goal is to implement sound financial practices to help the agency realize the highest cost savings and operate efficiently.
Now I'm going to stop you for just a moment, please, Jean. When you've got purchasing and coordinating purchasing within the Business Services Division, and we're sensitive to this because we've just seen Department of Administrative Services, and they've got a complete division for purchasing. I assume that whoever you have working in your purchasing is working directly with Department of Administrative Services and working on contracts with those folks.
Yes, and we do work with Department of Administrative Services, but we are not subject to DAS rules based on our constitutionality, but we do utilize the DAS contracts that they buy. You know, they do statewide contracting, and we utilize those.
Excellent. I appreciate the fact that you're constitutionally a separate branch. But that I don't know that constitutional license gives you a license to replicate other things, because it's my impression, and there are certainly those at this dais that are much more seasoned in this than am I. It's my impression that the reason we've got Department of Administrative Services doing this and why we've allocated resources to them to do the bulk purchasing is so that the governor's office and the secretary of state's office and the treasurer's office and the legislative and the judicial offices will not all go back out and reinvent the wheel. So that, and that's just
we
my
don't.
Concern. I just need that assurance.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Business Services tries to obtain the best value for the dollar, and one of the ways we do that is by using the state-wide contracting. But one of the things that we have an option to do is if we find a better price, we can buy off the statewide contract. And so we do have that option. And that has been able to save us. We obtain quotes on even low-dollar bids. So that has been able to save us, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars in our purchasing. We also achieved savings through sound contract administration and accounting practices.
And when you do print services, Jean, is that through the printing office? Or?
Yes. That's, Mr. Chair, statutorily you have to go to the state printer.
Oh, okay.
So we go to them for everything, and if they can't do it, then they find a contractor for us to use.
Senator Winters?
Can you give us, you mentioned that there were thousands of dollars. Can you give us a list of those dollar savings?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I can put together that list.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Jean.
All right. The division is funded with a 25% general fund, 75% other fund. This funding is based on the services that we provide the other divisions of our agency. The division is scheduled to take $9,000 cut in their general fund budget from the governor's balanced budget. We're planning to realize these through reduced spending in supplies and services, which would limit purchases in training and those kind of costs. Business Services Division has one
program. Chair.
Senator Winters, please.
What implications are those for your agency, the reduction of training? What is it? What's the impact?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we haven't calculated that specifically, but how our division does our training is each person, we take our total training dollars and allocate it out to each employee, and then they manage their own training budget. They have to submit how much they have left to their manager, and so this would be a portion of that would be done in there. We would also probably have to look at not buying computers or not buying equipment if we didn't need it, and really looking at our costs that way.
I'd like to go back to training. You said that they're given a dollar amount and then they can purchase. Can you provide me with the kinds of training that has been purchased by the individuals and what I'm getting at? It's nice if I can go out and provide my own training, but I would hope that the training that we're purchasing is related to the job or the increase in the job skills that exist for the benefit of the citizens of the state of Oregon, and not what happened with the lottery commission. You know, you did that audit, and I think we're all mindful of that. So I would like a copy of what training has been purchased. And my second question along that line, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator, follow up.
When you made those decisions to cut training, was that based on priority, or how did you make that decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that is just one of the categories that we would look at because it's one of the supplies and services. So training was one of them. We would look at our other supplies. That was just one that I mentioned. There are many that we'll look at. So training, of course, is one of them. But I don't know that I've specifically set aside a dollar amount that I'd be taking out of training as of yet.
Excuse me, Jean. While you're gathering the information for Senator Winters relative to the savings by buying off contract, and you're discussing the training issue, I assume we'll have some delineation of what the training is. But does Personnel Resource Division also do training within the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair, they coordinate training, yes, but I guess the training that I'm talking about is my employees going to, SFMA isn't a very good one because that's a no-cost training. So
that's an acronym that I don't even
know. Oh, I'm sorry, Statewide Financial Management.
Okay, all right. That
application,
won't cost you much.
It's the accounting system. I'll have to say that later. It's such a mouthful to say. I'm forgetting what the question was.
State financial sending out your employees.
You got me off track there,
versus,
Mr. Chair.
Versus personal
resources, they coordinate agency-wide training and looking at individual training needs for the department. What I'm talking about is my individual employees and the training that they get that is specific to their jobs. They have to present us with a reason, a benefit to their job, and how it would benefit the agency before they're allowed to take the training. And so it's a little bit different. This is more catered to the employees making their development in their job and a benefit to the agency, where the Personnel Resources Division is looking at overall policy and agency-wide training.
So now, are some of the Business Services Division's services contracted out for other than printing? Is that a valid question? Do you contract out other services other than just the printing to the print shop?
Well, Mr. Chair, we contract all contracts that any of the divisions have. So our IT contracts that are our information systems division, mm-hmm. we would be the one that managed the procurement process to make sure that it was in line with the ORS 279. Making sure we were following the competitive bid process. That's our role, is we handle the procurement process. If there is a need for computers or whatever, our division would handle getting the three bids and making sure that we got the lowest price. We also do travel arrangements if there have to be for our internal, our auditors.
That's for your agency, or is that for the full?
That is
Secretary
for
of State's office.
That's for the whole Secretary of State's
okay.
office. We're a centralized
services.
Business service
Good.
To the
and,
agency.
And so, at some point, Mr. Secretary, we'll need to. I would like to know, in addition to the issue of acquisitions and the training issues that have been brought up, any services that are contracted out for third parties, any kinds of contracts that the Secretary of State's office has out for. Whatever, whether it's contracted out for services for printing or for supplies, those kinds of things, to make certain that we're, if you can get a better deal on pencils and papers than the Department of Administrative Services at any time, I think the state needs to glom onto your contract and work with that. So if we could get a list of those. Thank you very much. Please continue.
The Business Services Division does have one program option package. Program option package 149 provides a reclassification of the accounting technician supervisor. This is the position that manages our deposit interface and all cashiering processes. This position changes in the position duties and responsibilities were identified during the annual review process. There was subsequent review by the Personnel Resources Division and determined that the position should be allocated to the classification of Principal Executive Manager A. The position is, like I said, responsible for managing all aspects of the cash processing for the agency. And this process has become more technical, requiring more technical expertise from management. This package actually is not going to require any additional funding. So we're kind of fortunate in that.
You're doing that within the existing funding with the 17 employees?
Yes.
I have a question.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And maybe it was answered yesterday and I just missed it. But the Secretary of State's office has responsibility for both financial and performance audits of state agencies. And, they also get into municipalities. Who audits the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we actually contract out to a local auditing firm to come in and do an independent audit of the Secretary of State every year.
But you request the audit.
We request the audit. The audits division is not part of that because they're not independent of our audit. So we contract.
The Secretary of State's Secretary of State's office orders the audit. Is that correct?
Yes. Senator Winters, Mr. Chair, yes.
And you put it out for bid. How do you give me your methodology?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, our methodology of our contracting process? Well, we produce a request for proposal
mm-hmm.
document with the scope of what we are asking them to look at.
So you define the scope?
Yes, it's based on, actually it is based on the same scope documents that the audits divisions use to contract, when they contract out for contract auditors for other agencies. We base it on those same principles.
Follow up. So you're utilizing the scope of practice that your audit division uses to send out the RFP and then when the RFPs are returned, you select the contractor, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's correct.
Have you had the same contractor pretty much over the last 5-10 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, actually, we have had the same contractor. We rebid it just 2 years ago, and they were the only contractor that was responsive. Didn't have anyone else bid.
You didn't have anyone else bid, and they've held the contract for how long?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I would have to check. I've been in this position 2 years, and okay. They've had it since I've been here, and I know they had it before, but I don't know how long before that. So I would have to check on that and get that for you.
I'm going down this path because, as the former state ombudsman, I'm always conscious of what we do internally to ourselves. And I like to avoid any appearance of the fox watching its own hen house, if I may. And so that's why I ask of how this was being done. On the one hand, we want independence in auditing other state agencies. We want that an outside source so that we're not being contaminated in any way. The Secretary of State's office is held in high esteem because they're going in independently, and I'm raising these questions because here you have a system where internally you're doing everything yourself, including your RFP specs and what have you. So it's a question that I'm raising because the public perception to me, to all of us, and to assure that we are having systems to where this independence is there.
Senator Winters, I appreciate the use of that word when it comes down to the independence and the auditing of contamination. I think that that's that's a new use of the word contamination when it comes to audits. And I'm going to use that somewhere. I'm not sure. Representative Patrick,
I'm stretching. Sorry.
Go ahead and stretch again if you'd like. Patrick, thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I do want to acknowledge the fact that we are very aware that because of the audits division being part of our agency, that we do live up to a higher standard within our business services division, and we try to meet that expectation because they are out there telling other agencies how to do it, and so we feel it's our obligation to make sure we're doing it the best way. We also do work with Department of Administrative Services, the Controller's Division, on our financial statements. So there is an outside agency that does review that.
I want to...
Senator, please.
I just think that it behooves us sometimes to kind of step back and look at how the process of the systems works, and I'm sure that you're probably doing an outstanding job. I just want to make sure that we don't have, and Bill understands where we're going because he's nodding his head. It would be no different than having human services do its own internal audits. And that's...
Please continue.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to move on to Personnel Resources Division. Personnel Resources Division provides human resource services consisting of advice and assistance in the interpretation and application of state and federal laws and policies and Secretary of State policies and procedures. They maintain a complete and confidential personnel record system and monitoring human resource management activities in the agency. Again, the division is funded with a 25% general fund, 75% other fund. Their funding is based on the FTE, full-time equivalency allocation for each division in the agency.
Do you know what percentage of their, you call it the other funds, but some it's general funds and all that other mush stuff together?
Laundered. Laundered general funds. How's that?
Okay.
They keep shrinking.
We're in a wash and rinse this morning. Do you have any idea of what percentage is what, Mr. Olson?
I don't.
Do you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you mean in the other fund,
mm-hmm.
what percentage
general
is? I can get you that information. We do have that. part of it is fully other funds because it comes from the corporations division. And I can give you the percentage that comes from the audits division that's other funds. That would be a mix of other funds, general fund. And I can get that information to you.
The audit piece would be of interest of how much of it is actually general fund that is with the federal funds and the other mixes would be of interest.
I think that will be important throughout your budget, Mr. Secretary, that we monitor very carefully. It's no secret to you, and you've been here before and been around this block until you've about worn out your shoe leather, I'm sure. But the concern that we have for monitoring the general funds, we come to the Personnel Resources Division, we've got 25% general funds, and in the General Services Division, we've got 25% general funds. We just need to be very cognizant of those, and so I'd like to have an opportunity probably to meet further with staff, and I don't know whether Lisa is prepared to discuss it privately or not, but just to try and track the general fund resources and then the mandate within the statute for the utilization of the general fund. And then I think that Senator Winter brings up an excellent point, and that is to monitor where those general funds are coming from as other funds, because we need to be cognizant of those as well. Senator Pett, or Representative Patridge, is stretching again.
Just stretching again. Told me I could, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You're welcome. Just continue on. I'll keep calling on you. Thank you very much. Jean, continue on. You're in the Personnel Resources
Division. Okay. Personnel Resources Division does have one program option package as well. Program Option Package 181 provides for a reclassification of the Personnel Resources Division's director's position from a Principal Exec Manager D to a Principal Exec Manager E. It also changes the service type from management service to unclassified service. It also provides for a reclassification of the agency's training coordinator position from an Office Specialist 2 to a Training Development Specialist 2. As vacancies have occurred at each division director level in the Secretary of State's office, the Secretary has designated each position as unclassified. 5 out of the 7 division directors' positions have previously been designated as unclassified. In the position classification, there was a position classification review done in May of 2001. In this review, it was determined that the position of personnel director should be more appropriately allocated to the principal exec manager E level. This reclassification is consistent with other similar positions in state government and is appropriate for the assigned responsibilities and authorities and provides for internal equity. The agency training coordinator position has evolved over the past few years from a clerical position into an agency-wide training coordinator. In addition, this position is responsible for monitoring the alternate dispute resolution issues and the annual reporting. It was noted in the review conducted by the Department of Administrative Services in conjunction with their administrative classification study that it appeared that this position should be classified as a training development specialist. Since the position was not allocated during phase one of that classification study, the reclassification needed to be processed in our budget package. The Personnel Resources Division conducted an analysis of the job duties and comparison, the class specifications, and determined that the position should be allocated to a training development specialist too. This package will be funded through an increase to our other fund limitation of $687. And do you have any questions?
Senator, I do. And you mentioned dispute resolution, that the position had taken on some of those responsibilities. As a result of those responsibilities, have your AG's costs gone up or down?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, honestly, I don't know because of this alternative dispute plan if they've gone down. Quite a bit of our AG costs are very much out of our control because of the elections division, unfortunately. But I can check to see. I don't think that we've done a study to really correlate.
Then I guess the question I then would ask, what are the duties and responsibilities of the person involved in dispute resolution, and what are some of the disputes, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you know, I will honestly have to go back and check because this is not one of my positions, so I don't know intimately what their duties are, but I can get that for you. Okay.
Other follow-up other questions? Thank you, Gene. Appreciate your review of those two, and I've asked staff a couple of questions regarding the reclassing and the I do want to confirm that it sounded like the personnel services was doing a lot of things that the business services division may have some relationship to, so but we'll come back to that. Other questions for Gene while she's here? Thank you very much, Gene. We'll go to Peter Trelka, Director of Corporate Division.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Trelka, and I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. It's my pleasure to be here this morning. The Corporation Division is responsible for the state's business registration programs, recording Uniform Commercial Code financing statement filings, and commissions and regulates notaries public. We also operate the state's Business Information Center as a cooperative outreach effort with six state agencies to provide information to the public on how to start a business in Oregon, and in addition, information on government registration and licensing requirements for business. We also publish and distribute the Oregon Business Guide. The division is funded entirely through the fees paid by the users of our services. We are 100% of their fund. Gaining efficiency through the implementation of technology is a primary focus for the division. We've had great success in the implementation of new technology, and our customers have responded overwhelmingly by taking greater advantage of our online information services. Our business registry programs, which include assumed business names, corporations, limited liability companies, and the limited partnerships, have used technology to increase the public's access to business information filings. These filings are a public record, and the public currently conducts over 271,000 online searches of our business name search system every month without staff assistance. Previously, this information was only available by calling our OSCI call center during business hours. By putting the business registry system online, calls to the call center have dropped significantly, allowing us to reduce call center staff by over 50%. In addition, business owners can now renew their business registration online with the state's new ePay e-commerce system. Secretary of State was selected as the pilot agency to work with the Department of Administrative Services to build the state's e-commerce system. The first e-commerce transactions were completed in November, and the system became fully operational in January. We are now sharing lessons learned and key success stories with other state agencies, including Department of Motor Vehicles, as they begin their implementation of ePay. Another new online service is the Business Wizard. This went online just this past Friday. The Business Wizard uses a dynamic interview process to provide business owners with a customized referral list of government licensing, registration, and regulatory contacts, as well as other organizational contacts such as their local chamber of commerce. The referral list can be saved to the user's computer desktop and used later as a unique navigational tool to locate government agencies, forms, requirements, and services for their particular business. Previously, this was the service of the Business Information Call Center at OSCI, and a customer would call in. They would talk to one of the phone representatives, and after going through a series of interview questions, we would produce a referral list, and we'd mail it out with a packet of information, and it would arrive a few days later. The new system is online, it's immediate, and provides links to all of the other agencies that relate to that business's organization, location, and setup. While Business Registry Online, ePay, and the Business Wizard are all great tools to streamline access to government information and services for business, Their real potential is that they form the foundation for the state's central business registry as a one-stop shop to allow businesses or business owners to register with multiple state agencies from a single online application. A little later, Scott Smith, our Information Services Director, will talk to you about a program option package to allow the Secretary of State to build the remaining components of the Central Business Registry system. During the division, during the biennium, the division also implemented a new uniform commercial code system. Liens and financing statements presented for filing are imaged, and the image and the data record are available for search online. This information, previously the public had to pay $10 per search to be completed manually and wait a day or two for the results to be mailed. Today, over 21,000 UCC searches are completed online every month, saving the public time and money.
Representative Patridge is recognized.
Have you audited that system versus what some of these private companies have? I've run into a couple situations where we've done a UCC search through you guys and done one through your online method versus having a outsourced service do a UCC search and have turned up different information. I'm wondering what kind of internal controls you put in place in terms of checking your UCC online versus what private companies are pulling up.
Chairman Butler, Representative Patridge, no, we have not done any audits between our results and results of third-party vendors. I wasn't aware that there have been any discrepancies.
Yeah, I might suggest that you do that. I mean, I've done that. I think we've done that twice on various issues, on some bond issues, kinds of things to do some
discrepancies in both situations.
Well, the Secretary of State's UCC search didn't turn up what a private search firm's search turned up, and so my concern is if we're holding it out there as kind of the end all be all, because I know a lot of law firms and other people are still using private search firms as well as have trained people to do online. So I just want to make sure that you guys do some internal auditing to make sure some of those things happen. And maybe mine were just unique. I'm happy to share some of those with you.
Chairman Butler, Representative Patrick, I appreciate that information. And that was being on track. I'd like to follow up on that.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Happy to help, yes.
Senator Winters is recognized.
Thank you. Can you go back just a little bit on the training? And it's your bullet where you offer free education training to various constituency groups. Can you give me some idea of what type of training that you have offered? And I'm assuming that the groups, and correct me if I'm wrong, are from the business community, but just what that entails.
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, the primary training that we've done is with the notary public groups. We offer free on-site training. Last year, we provided training to over 2,500 notaries throughout all parts of the state. We've conducted, I believe, about 52 training sessions. And the training sessions usually run about 3 hours. We cover all kinds of issues with regards to notary law, typical situations, problems that notaries have reported to us, and common questions that they've asked to have answered. We also provide training to other state agencies on some of our business tools, and we're also going out. We've done some training on the Business Information Center as well.
What question? Do you follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up,
do you also oversee the licensing of the notary and the training that's conducted at the state fairgrounds? Do you oversee that, or is there some other agency that's responsible for that? Are you involved in anything in training a person to become a notary?
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, yes, we are. The training classes that we offer are available for new notaries as well as existing notaries. I think a lot of the The attendees have been individuals that have been notaries for a number of years. The Notary Commission runs for 4 years. Every 4 years at renewal time, the notary has to complete an open book test and pass that test to renew or to become a new notary at that point. So one of the things that we are planning to build is an online notary education tutorial system.
Do you provide a fee for that service?
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, no, we're not charging a fee for any of the training that we're providing.
Are some of those notary publics charging for their services? Is it lucrative in some cases?
Chairman Butler, yes. Some notaries, in the notary system, when you sign up as a notary, you either have to declare that you are going to charge fees for notary services or that you will waive fees. And so we make no distinction on who we allow to come to the training. Our focus is to have better notaries in Oregon so that they're better able to detect and prevent fraud.
How many of the breakdown of the total notaries in the state, Peter, are there that have lucrative versus non-lucrative notary seals? You know,
Chairman Butler, of the 44,000 notaries, I don't have that information available, but I can provide that for you.
Seems like that for those that are doing it as a public service, those folks, surely that might be a service the Secretary of State's office could provide. But for those folks, I just was charged for the first time in my life for a notary service not long ago, and $5 for a signature at a local bank. I guess I'll wait for my secretary to get back in the office. So,
and Mr. Chair, I'm saying that because we're in some very austere budget climate, and I'm, you know, looking at, you know, it's nice if we can continue to give everything free, but, you know, to be honest, I don't think we can. And where you have, you know, those that are doing it for public service, that's one thing, but those who are actually benefiting financially from it, there's something altogether different. And so that's why I'm posing this question. I happen to be in the position of having one of probably the toughest committees in this building, so I'm looking for every, you need to know, I'm looking for every G fee under fund revenue that I can so that the hungry, and Bill knows where I'm going on this. We have some serious
issues. Senator Winters wants those training dollars to be diverted to the Department of Human Services.
You've got it right.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Butler, Senator Winters, we do have proposed legislation this year that mandates notary training, and along with that, we have requested a $5 surcharge to fund notary training that be charged to all notaries. So that's currently going through the hearings process.
Seems like you could make it a whole lot easier if you just charge those for the lucrative positions, and because the fee is not insubstantial. My daughter had to have deeds and bills of sale notarized at her bank in Grants Pass recently, and I think there were three documents, and she said I got mailed $15 for them, and I'm looking at that and saying, boy, that looks like to me that could become quite a business. I mean, $15 in 15 minutes is a pretty good rate of return. So, and that's one of their bank customers. So, anyway, my angst is that we do exactly what Senator Winters is recommending, and that is maybe we just take a closer look at the lucrative portion of that as opposed to those that are giving those out as a public service. Please continue.
One of our goals for the future is to continue to automate our programs through the use of technology by offering electronic filing. E-filing will be implemented in an environment that allows business owners to use secure password-protected accounts to file and maintain document records. E-filing will allow us to continue to automate and reduce our future reliance on labor-intensive manual processes. Once the e-filing systems are built, our initial goal is to have 50% of all filing transactions handled electronically. A critical component of achieving this vision of e-government are the staff who understand the program, system issues, and process issues. Program Option Package 151 will reclassify one position from an Office Specialist 2 to a Research Analyst 3 to serve the duties of our Uniform Commercial Code Applications Administrator. The incumbent of this position has first-line responsibility to ensure that the data system is operating effectively and efficiently so that customers can receive timely and accurate service, and the division can minimize the staff required to manually process customer documents. This concludes my prepared presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Further questions, Mr. Shelkill? Seeing none, thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate it. Ross McKean, Director of the Oregon Cultural Trust.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Ross McKean. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Oregon Cultural Trust. I'd like to start, if I could, with some quick background about the trust, then move into the 03-05 budget implications, if I may. The Oregon Cultural Trust was created by the 2001 legislature as an innovative funding plan to strengthen and preserve culture throughout Oregon. The program grew out of a lot of work by a great many Oregonians, private citizens, cultural advocates, civic leaders, and business leaders, as well as legislators who were seeking new approaches to providing proper funding for Oregon's cultural resources, finding an alternative to continually coming to the legislature and asking for general fund appropriations, if I may be specific about it. A motivating factor behind the creation of the trust is the fact that Oregon consistently ranks at the bottom of a listing of state funding for arts agencies, an annual study that's done by the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies. And that desire to improve our ranking on that scale was reflected in the Oregon benchmarks, which adopted benchmark number 37, which called for moving Oregon from near the bottom of the pack to closer to the middle of the pack over a period of years. The Cultural Trust is one mechanism for doing this.
Excuse me, Ross, let me just ask a question about that. Do you know whether in that national survey, and I'm getting just a little bit jaundiced about these surveys that show Oregon the bottom of almost everything. You know, I mean, if I get five more surveys this week that show that Oregon is the worst state in the nation for me to be living in, I'm going to move. I guess my concern is that when we do this kind of a survey that shows that Oregon is among the bottom states that dedicate money for cultural trust or for cultural activities, does that include the 1% capital that we expend every time we throw a building up in the state?
Let me be clear, and to be fair, that is one measurement of funding of culture. So I do want to be clear that you're right. That is one measurement of state funding for state arts agencies, and it's not the only measurement that is important in this.
But when all of the states are gathering up their totals, does Oregon throw into that total the 1% and capital that it puts towards the arts?
I believe it does not.
Does not.
Right.
Okay. Well, that might make Oregon a much better place to live in if I knew that maybe we were somewhere in the middle in that process as opposed to the bottom end, because I see all this beautiful art on our freeways and in front of our public buildings and those kinds of things, and I think it's absolutely beautiful. But then I find out that we're a state without culture and without art, and I say, gee, man, is that really the kind of place that I'd like to live and raise my family?
Right. Well, let me correct you, the perception and say Oregon is a place that's full of great culture and great art. And it's not only due to the limited amount of state funding that's provided, but by a great amount of support from private individuals and businesses and foundations.
Perhaps you could give me that statistic that shows that we're on the bottom end, and then see what it looks like for me, if you would, please, once you throw back in the 1% on the capital construction.
We can take a look at that.
Thank you very much.
Take a look at that issue.
Appreciate it.
And I raise that statistic only to reference the one particular benchmark. I should say that measures funding for arts. One of the important things to understand about the Cultural Trust is that it defines culture broadly to include heritage and humanities as well as the arts. And this is an important factor here as we look at what makes Oregon a rich place to live. It's not just arts programs, certainly not just arts programs in urban settings, but it's rural programs, it's historical societies, it's pioneer cemeteries, heritage sites, archaeological sites, it's reading programs in libraries, which are the center of cultural activity in many rural districts. And so this is a broad definition of culture. Over the 10-year period for the trust, the trust was established to, as a long-term plan. The fund will grow primarily through gifts from individuals and businesses, voluntarily, but with encouragement from the Oregon tax credit. The new cultural license plate, which just became available earlier this month, will generate annual earnings into the fund from citizens who volunteer to pay the $30 surcharge for a plate. And as you know, the legislature in the last session designated proceeds from the sale of certain lands would help to get the Oregon Cultural Trust started.
Rep. St. Patrick is recognized.
I just want to say, Mr. Chair, I am concerned with I have seen the license plate. While it may be art and culture, it is the ugliest license plate I've seen that we have. So I'm concerned whether it will generate any funds. But that's my own personal taste and imposed upon it. But I don't know how many people have seen that. But
Mr. Chair,
interesting looking license plate. I would encourage.
Perhaps
you to
we can encourage Russ to bring us one. I think I've seen one, but it didn't stand out. Representative Johnson.
Well, Representative Patrick has opened the door to a number of questions that
she's going to tell us that she's got one on her motorcycle.
How'd you know? I'd be curious if you could provide for us a breakdown of the consultant services that the trust is using for the design work on the brochures. I presume consultants were brought in to do the design work on the license plate. Maybe that material is already in our books. I haven't studied
I don't believe that breakdown is there. We can provide it.
I'd like very much to know what has been expended on consultants to this point to do the brochure work and the mail house work for the December appeal. I understand that a PR firm has been employed, so I'd like all of those included, if you wouldn't mind.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we can certainly put together a report on those numbers. A PR firm was employed for our public outreach campaign during the fall, as well as preparing materials. The license plate itself was designed through an open competition. There was a fee paid to the winner of that open competition. We had over 100 designs submitted, and in response to Representative Patridge's comments, that's one of the beauties of art and culture is that the individual can make judgments. I have two sets. I actually think they look quite good on my cars, and I've heard comments, and I think the license plate choice was a bold and innovative one, which many people respond positively to, and actually works well on the car. But personal opinion is certainly
and Representative Johnson, prior to Gene Street, we've asked about all contracts of the agency. We need to find out, but this is particularly timely with regard to the Cultural Trust. Recognize Representative Johnson again.
You spooked the question right out of me, Mr. Chair. It'll come to me.
Thank you, Representative Patridge.
Can you tell who was retained ultimately on that to do the outreach?
The outreach in this last campaign was a Fleischmann Hillard company was retained for that work. Formerly KBO. That contract was for work through the December campaign is now over. We do not currently have a contract for ongoing work.
I still would like to know how
yeah,
much
oh yeah,
was.
Absolutely.
I understand because I made the inquiry about the possibility of getting a license plate for Oregon for the Lewis and Clark bicentennial activities. And I was told that in order to do that, there has to be an upfront fee paid of $150,000 to do the setup work at ODOT. Could you detail in the same little report that you're making for us? I think that the money for the setup of the cultural trust plate came from the operating fund at ODOT. What the plan is to repay that? Will you be using donations that came from folks responding to the December campaign? And if you are, I have concern about donative intent. And if you are using money that was set aside from the last legislative session for the trust, how that's all going to work. So I'd like to know what the plan is to pay back the operating trust from the proceeds of the license plate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we can provide a detailed breakdown of that. I can give a quick answer. That is that the legislation that established the trust defined that ODOT money would be the upfront money and that it would be repaid out of a small part of the surcharge for new plates, that as people buy the new plates, the $30 surcharge, and I can't remember the amount, a small portion of that would first pay back that upfront cost. I can detail that.
You might just add as a postscript how sales are going, because it seems as though our license plate environment is getting increasingly competitive. I think that $150,000 threshold may have a chilling effect on folks stepping up unless they can work a mechanism to use other people's money to front the production costs. But I'd like to know what the anticipated payback horizon for that $150,000 is.
We can provide that.
Thanks.
I just a question for Representative Johnson. We used to have an Oregon Trail license plate. I understand that's no longer available. And it's my understanding maybe that's because of the Lewis and Clark potential, or is that?
As I understand it, Mr. Chair, and the only reason I know anything about this is that I had a constituent who was a Pearl Harbor survivor, and he and his wife had moved out of the state, surrendered their Oregon Pearl Harbor plates in Arizona, eventually came back to Oregon, and he wanted to get his Pearl Harbor plates back. And there are no more Pearl Harbor plates, and given the limited universe of folks that might buy those, ODOT made the decision that absent the $150,000 setup, they wouldn't do it. So I don't know whether the Oregon Trail plate had a finite lifespan, or the money was paid back, or ODOT just ran out of the plates, or the market had fallen off so sharply there was no incentive to continue to produce them. But I know that $150,000 bar is a problem.
Okay. Please proceed.
I beg your pardon. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to state something about the license plates themselves in the sense that in two sessions being on the Transportation Committee, I have seen a lot of license plate bills, an enormous number, and there usually are at least two or three every session. And maybe this one will actually make money. But the bulk of them, the vast majority of requests, never actually make money. I think that's something people have to carefully evaluate in terms of proposing them, because with the exception of a handful, everybody thinks that everybody will buy a special license plate, but the vast majority of them that never actually make money.
I think that's a valid comment. Representative
Patrick? My other concern is I don't like the license plate stuff at all. I think it's a public safety concern. You can't identify license plates. I mean, you try and identify license plates, and that's a valid concern that I think law enforcement brings to the table on a regular basis. But that's an aside for this particular piece.
And Representative Johnson.
At the risk of piling on in this discussion, I think some level of discipline with the agencies to police up the promises that plates be paid back. I know we've done two in the last session, the Trust and the Crater Lake plate, and as laudable as those plates are, I agree with Senator Devlin's observation that we can have a plethora of these plates funded through all kinds of odd funding mechanisms, and there's no discipline to police up the payment.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. In terms of the results of our campaign in the fall, during our first fundraising campaign in December 2002, and I remind the subcommittee that we were limited by, I believe, a budget compromise early on to collecting the tax credit gifts in December only for 2002. We received over $1.6 million in voluntary contributions from more than 4,400 Oregonians from pretty much all around the state. The response was enthusiastic. I spoke with probably hundreds of citizens personally who were uniformly grateful for the opportunity to participate in this program, who praised it as an innovative approach, liked the fact that they had a choice of how they direct some of their tax dollars and the like.
Just one question, and then we'll go to Representative Johnson. I wanted to make sure. It's my understanding from the testimony yesterday of Secretary Bradbury that what we did was we allowed those to be charged on credit cards, and I would like to know what our credit card charge rate is, whether that's funneled through the Secretary of Treasury, the Treasurer's office, or what our rate is. There seems to be some question about I'm getting other agencies that are using credit cards more and more, and they're being charged at rather substantial rates, and that's of concern to me. So if we could get
some report of how much of that and what the rate of chargeback is. Representative
Johnson. Thank you. Out of these 4,400 Oregonians, and I guess what prompts this question is, I sit on the board of a charitable foundation, and we occasionally get contributions, and we are scrupulously concerned about donative intent. I would assume out of this universe of 4,400 Oregonians, the great number of them gave directly to the trust, or they specified their own. How much donative intent is wrapped up in this 4,400?
Representative Johnson, as the rules for this program are that to earn the tax credit, the donor must first make a gift to a qualified cultural organization, nonprofit, and then make a matching gift to the cultural trust. So in these cases, these are individuals who have first contributed directly to organizations of their choosing.
That are on your list.
That are on our list.
How did organizations get on your list?
The list was, the base list was from the Department of Justice providing us with a list of corporations registered in Oregon as cultural. That was the basis of the list. We then made it clear, worked with the Department of Revenue in the definition, well, the law specifically, you know, it's very clear about the definition of cultural organizations. And as we learned of organizations, because they contacted us or donors contacted us and said, we're not on the list, we asked them to provide us evidence that they were a 501c3 nonprofit and evidence from their mission statement that they were primarily organized as a cultural organization. And if on the face of it, it was clear that they were, we would add them to our list.
Hey, let me just, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, pursue how this works. I sit in my home and I make up my contribution to the Scappoose Historical Society.
That's right.
And I've now made a $500 contribution to them. I now can make a simultaneous $500 contribution to you, and I get the $500 write-off.
You get a tax credit to us. You get the deduction for the gift to Scappoose Historical Society.
How do you verify that I've made my payment to the Scappoose Historical Society?
Department of Revenue verifies that. This is worked out with the Department of Revenue in terms of implementation, and like any tax deduction that you claim, it's up to you to retain the evidence of it and to prove it to the Department of Revenue and audit it to you. And that's the way our tax system is based for a great many things. It's, in a sense, an honor system. So we do not have the capability to independently verify that they've made those contributions. The Department of Revenue has said that that is acceptable to them, that that's the normal way you claim a deduction for charitable contributions. You are required to retain that in your tax records and produce evidence of it, if asked to produce evidence of it. To do otherwise, I think, would add another kind of bureaucratic level to what we're doing and would be difficult. Now, in terms of donor intent, there are a few, I would say a handful, of contributions that we received where the donor wrote on the donation slip, I want this to go to OPB, or I want this to go, and we have contacted those people and said, do you understand how this works? This is not a direct contribution, and in most cases they've said, oh, that's fine, I did make a gift already to them, leave it as it is, and in others we've made arrangements to return their money because they didn't understand how it works. We've tried to be very careful about that.
One more.
Follow up.
One of the complaints that I have heard from some local folks is that, in essence, through the Cultural Trust, donors are now in little museums, and I'm just picking museum as an example, are now in competition with the state. And give me the rationale to answer that complaint, that pick the Scappoose Museum, and that they are very small, have a well-established, I'm making this up, there is no Scappoose Museum, but and they have
cultural trust, there will.
They have a well-established donor base, and now all of a sudden they are competing for the same donor who might have written them a $1,000 check. You are in competition with them to get half of their historic donor's contribution. What reassurance do they have that they will ever see that half come back through? Is your distribution formula organized in such a way that the Scappoose Museum ever sees what they have given up by sharing their donor with you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'll answer that probably in three different parts, if I may. First to the last piece, there is no automatic guarantee that they will see any part of it back. And we've had a great many cultural organizations across the state voluntarily help us in promoting this because they understood that it was a long-term plan that raised all the boats in the harbor and would ultimately benefit them. So, but we've made it clear to people that if you, as an organization, as the Scappoose Historical Society, help promote us, there's no quid pro quo there automatically. With regard to what's to prevent donors from splitting their gift, and the example of a $1,000 gift, you're absolutely right. From a tax perspective, that donor is better off giving $500 to us and $500 to the Scappoose Historical Society. From my experience with fundraising and with fundraising in the arts in particular, but I think it's true elsewhere, this is the first part of the question, donors, in my experience, typically give to organizations because they believe in the mission, they believe in the leadership of the organization, not out of tax benefits. The tax benefits are a side benefit. And in fact, some focus group work that's been done around kind of why do you give to the arts, people say that. It's way down on the list in terms of why they're giving. So I believe that in that calculation, that mental calculation, they're giving out of more of an emotional connection than a bottom line tax benefit. So that's one part of the answer. The other part is that in this campaign particularly, we targeted our outreach to people who had already given to organizations. So at that point, the donors had already given, most of them, $1,000 to the Scappoose Historical Society. And we're not in a position to say, well, I'm going to take that back and switch it around. Now, in the future, that maybe, as they're aware of it, could become another issue. But I think most importantly is the evidence, and this is anecdotal evidence to be truthful at this stage. We're working to look at the patterns that happen. We heard a lot of stories from individuals and from organizations that found that it was exactly the opposite effect. That in fact, for instance, the example that was common is somebody that typically had given $300 to the Scappoose Historical Society looked at this and said, I'm going to give $200 more to the society now, and so I can take the full $500 gift. I heard personally from individuals that were doing that were rounding up now to take full advantage of it. And I think the fact that it's at that $500 level means that all those people in the $100 to $400 range are finding there's an incentive. I mean, there's really not a bottom line incentive because it's a net no gain for them, but psychologically there is. And then we've heard from organizations who, in their donor letters and their year-end pitches for contributions, have written to us and have told us that they've seen that jump 10 to 15%. From people who at the end of the year were saying, I already gave, I'm going to give you more now as part of this. And again, that's anecdotal evidence. We haven't tallied that up to see whether overall that's been the effect. It's the effect we hoped for, that over time we would in fact encourage increased philanthropy. And that was one of the fundamental goals of this, is to boost that leg of the funding. It's not all public funding. It's to also boost the philanthropy from private individuals. We were gratified to see some anecdotal evidence for that. My favorite story is I got a check from a woman in Eugene who sent us $75, and she enclosed three $25 checks to the Eugene Symphony and two other organizations and said, could you please forward these to them on my behalf? I've decided to increase, to start giving to them. And another woman that called to say, I want to do this. Who do you suggest that I give it to in Eugene? And I told them to call the Regional Arts Council there and get advice, but new donors that were interested in taking advantage of this. I hope that answers.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson is our resident expert in philanthropic affairs, being highly motivated by Elia Mossenary.
My favorite word.
Background. Thank you.
I want to move to the 2003-2005 budget implications. Just a touch more background, a reminder about the statute itself. By law, the trust may spend no more than 42% of its July 1st balance for grant programs and for distribution of funding. 58% is retained to build this permanent endowment over the next 10 years. That permanent endowment, which once established will generate interest, which will provide the long-term funding. But by law, we can only spend 42% now. Of the 42% that we can distribute in grants, we are allowed to spend only 7.5% of that amount for administrative purposes. And in terms of kind of overall overhead allocations, it's really a pretty small amount. And especially with the balance where it is now, and if I may at some risk add at the balance at which we are at risk of becoming, if that in fact goes down, we will be in a more difficult situation, because as it is now, until the endowment fund, the trust fund, grows over the next 2 to 3 years, it'll take 2 to 3 years before it's of a sufficient size that overhead percentage is enough to sustain us even at a bare minimum level of operation. And I believe that when this budget was presented in the last session, there were concerns expressed about what happens next and would we need general fund support to keep us going until we reach that self-sustaining level.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then it begs the obvious question. One of your policy option packages is to raise the compensation of the executive director. Given what you just said, rationalize for me why the legislature ought to approve that reclass.
Well, one issue would be that one of the strategies that we have to make up that difference, to fill that gap, is that we need to intensify our fundraising effort from private foundations specifically. That's a strategy that we've adopted and in fact, have had some beginning success with leading regional foundations who understand the importance of the trust, understand that their role can be to help get us started, and to fill that gap, our approach is to, first of all, keep our budget at a minimal level with only 2 FTE and a kind of minimum overhead, but the second part is to seek private foundation funding for the difference. We've had some success with the Meyer Memorial Trust, the Collins Foundation, and the Miller Foundation. We have a number of other proposals pending. But for the next 2 to 3 years, to be able to keep that level of funding to get us through that period, it's going to take an individual in that position that has some experience, some ability to do that kind of cultivation, to build confidence in the organization, and to be able to kind of move on that front. So I think that's one issue. I believe the other issue with the reclassification was to provide some flexibility in terms of amount of compensation. As it is now, the position, speak personally, is at the top of the range. I'm not interested in this in the long term. I'm an interim appointment, but that means there's at the current expense level, there's no flexibility for growth or recruitment, for adjustments within that range. So it provides some, even if it's not at a higher ultimate cost.
One last question.
Representative Johnson.
So if the interim position now is at the top step, after the reclass, what would be the compensation at the top step of the new reclass?
I would have to defer to Dean Stray.
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to get that for you. I can get that.
Would you please?
I think that brings up an issue that is of concern. I think those of us who were faced with the funding of the Cultural Trust early on looked at it and were concerned, but we were assured that the charitable intent of most of the people who would come and donate and dedicate their time to the Cultural Trust was going to be such that we weren't going to be faced with a lot of additional costs. Also, I hearken back to a few years before I got here with one of the advocacy commissions that was formed with the understanding that this wouldn't cost the general fund anything for this particular advocacy commission coming online with the other advocacy commissions, because that particular group of folks within the state of Oregon were very independent and wanted to have an advocacy commission just to represent the fact that they were represented. Wasn't but another 2 years, and they were back after general funds and then back after equal general funds to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars in one of those particular bienniums. So I guess my concern is that I thought that more of this was going to be done from charitable purposes and from the charitable motives as opposed to the compensation. But that's I think that's reasonable for the Secretary of State to ask for compensation if we're going to get into the professional fundraising business, too. So please continue on.
Mr. Chairman.
I beg your pardon, Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a request of legislative fiscal because I think it makes some of these discussions easier, is if we could be provided with the corresponding salaries for each of the state's pay ranges, because all we'd have to know from a reclassification is what the pay range change was to know what the change is in compensation. So
that's a legitimate request. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Probably ought to have that in the possession of each of the LFO analysts that come to the table, or if we get BAM analysts in the room too. So, okay, please.
Well, with regard to the strategy, and to get back to the general fund issue, very early on, I think almost without question from the beginning, the strategy from the Secretary of State and the Board of Directors for the Cultural Trust was to not come into the next biennium with any request for general funds, despite this gap and despite the challenge of needing to make up the difference in through private foundation funding. It was clear from the conditions of the state's fiscal condition and the like that it was not appropriate or reasonable at that time to come back. And I think in keeping with the communication early on that said this will become self-sustaining, to say that we are not proposing in the 03-05 budget any general fund appropriations, and perhaps I'm just making the point we could sorely use it, but clearly it's not something that's on our agenda. In addition, the original projections from the trust presumed that it would grow through additional allocations of surplus state land that would be designated. That was part of the strategy and idea. But again, for similar reasons, we have not anywhere on our agenda presumed that we would make requests for additional surplus lands in this.
Mr. McKean, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. McKean, where does that leave the Mill Creek site?
That is still designated for the trust and for the Department of Corrections. It is has undergone some land use planning and estimation. And my understanding is that the projection now is that for that to have sort of best use and maximum value, it will require development over the next 5 to 10 years in cooperation with the City of Salem and others for it to really be maximum value. So at this point, it's still there with, under the statute, the agreement that a portion of it comes to the Cultural Trust, but it's not nowhere in our balances or available at this moment. I believe as agricultural property, as it currently is, it may not even be marketable, but it may be worth only $1 million, whereas over a 5 to 10 year period with infrastructure and land use planning and the like, it could be substantially more than that. But at this stage, it's nothing we've projected in our budget estimations, because it's going to be several years before any of that materializes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representing.
Will the trust
the
then...
The chair's going to go ahead and yield again.
No, I'm done.
You've got several questions, I'm sure, in that regard. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the trust then be expected to participate in the costs associated with the infrastructure?
My understanding is that we would, to the extent that the net value at the end would include the costs of developing it, but that we would not be expected to be putting up money, for instance, for infrastructure development or land use planning for it. But in fact, I think the strategy is more that the City of Salem and Department of Administrative Services in some manner would share that investment cost, recognizing that down the road there'd be, repayment of it through increased property values and the like. But we would not be kind of directly taxed, so to speak, for that.
I guess the concern that I have and the question that really that Representative Johnson has asked kind of leaves visions of the Cultural Trust getting into the subdivision and to the land development business. And if this property is going to be held to reach its highest and best value, so I think probably the highest and best value would be for a property, a subdivision developer, an actual property developer, to go and be selling off these lots. And that's the question that I would have at that particular point. Is that where we're headed with regard to, what is it, I guess 1,000 acres, isn't it?
It's more than that, actually, Mr. Chair.
Well, I mean, it goes directly to the trust as 1,000 acres.
At this point, I don't know. The site was master planned in 1999 by a very credible engineering firm up in Portland as an industrial campus, not residential, but commercial and industrial mixed-use campus. And then the discussion came about where DPSST was going to be located. And my apprehension that DPSST had just sort of plopped itself down in the middle of the site, then ran into environmental problems, then selected another site. And my concern was, after we had spent as a state nearly $100,000 master planning this thing in 1999, threw that master plan aside, let DPS cherry pick where their site was going to be. And my concern was, with a in excess of 1,000 acre, maybe close to 2,000 acre industrial campus site with the kind of access that it had, in order to maximize the value of that site to both corrections, the trust of the citizens of Oregon, that allowing DPSST to cherry pick that site was not something that I thought was very desirable. And frankly, I was surprised that there hadn't been a little more concern raised on the part of the trust, because as the ultimate beneficiary of the maximization of the sale price, you guys should want to make sure that the whole site had not been diminished in some significant way by allowing DPSST to just hunt for a spot, even if it meant taking the center of the watermelon, in order to appease neighbors from the environmental concerns that are concomitant with racetracks and sirens and shooting ranges and all the rest of that stuff. So at this point, as my understanding is, we're entering into another set of master planning to now try to accommodate the fact that DPSST has staked out their claim. And I don't know whether that leaves you all with all the wetlands and all the oak savanna and all the stuff that eventually cannot be developed. So it is of great concern to me how a major asset of the state of Oregon gets parceled up. And I think it ought to concern the trust.
Representative Johnson, it has concerned the trust, and people have been involved. I haven't been directly involved, but people who are on the trust board have been involved working with the Department of Administrative Services to make sure that the property is divided fairly, not divided the way it was originally proposed.
I lied, Mr. Chair. One more point. One of the other things that has been a wonderment to me is the constant reassurance that DPSST has cut a deal with corrections that will allow them to have maximum, to have the required amount of water and other sanitary sewer facilities shared with the prison. Apparently to the exclusion of everybody else. And so I don't know whether that leaves your piece of the Mill Creek site with even higher development costs, because once again DPSST was allowed to come in and cherry pick their sanitary connections, leaving all the rest of the property as bare property, meaning you're starting with needing to get a shovel. And I think that it is not simply a matter of the raw real estate sale value, but it certainly begs the question of how to service a site where your site may have been excluded from existing hookups based on capacity. Now I am done, Mr. Chair.
Okay. let's continue on. Let's see if we can't maybe go ahead and get to the bottom of our list today. Mr. McKee, did you have further...
Just really one last point, and it doesn't affect so much the spending end of things as the revenue end of things. We've informed the Legislative Revenue Office that the expected impact of the Oregon Cultural Trust tax credit will be less than expected during the 2003-2005 biennium, whereas the original projection, and I believe what had been budgeted, was something around the order of $18 million as the tax credit impact. We believe from our projections now that that will be more like $9 million, and Legislative Revenue Office has been informed of that in terms of revisions to the 2003-2005 revenue projections, that it's likely to be a lower number.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I know this has been a somewhat difficult hearing for Mr. McKean, but I just wanted to assure him that he had actually arrived, or the Cultural Trust had. It's gotten to the level of the OPB, because I've had two emails. These are the kinds of, all of us will get these kinds of emails, that have said that if we just scrutinize the budget of the Cultural Trust, we could solve this budget problem the state has. So.
Boy, I will.
So you have arrived.
That was true.
Senator Devlin, I need to know, did this make it to the 54 list of AOI?
No, it didn't quite make it.
All right. It hasn't fully arrived.
That's true.
Well, if I could just close with the general statement that when we're asked how can we justify this, it's really justifying it on the sense of the state participating with the private sector in making an investment that will have returns for Oregon over the short and long term in the areas of economic growth, educational improvement, and community strengthening in terms of the role that culture can play in defining what we are as a state, whether it's cultural tourism, heritage tourism was mentioned, a million people that are expected to come for the Lewis and Clark exhibit as an example, the proven impacts on educational creativity and leadership and the kinds of skills we need in our children today to attract businesses here, and as well as lots of stories of communities that have been improved by investing in culture. We truly believe it's part of the solution to the problem, certainly over the long term, not part of the problem, but in fact is something that's a wise investment. And it's difficult to make those wise investments in the short term when there's short term serious problems to make, but I view it as akin to Intel continuing to invest in research and development during a recession because they know that when things turn around, they'll be behind if they haven't done that, and investing in culture in this manner is an important part of that strategy, we believe. I thank you for your time. And
thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Appreciate it. Any further questions of the Oregon Cultural Trust? John Lindbeck, Elections Division. We're going to try and get through as much as we possibly can today and see if we can't have Scott, Mr. Lindbeck and Scott Smith and get as far as we can today, and then we'll talk about what we need to get done tomorrow. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm John Lindbeck. I'm Director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. I'm going to start out telling you a little bit what the responsibilities of the Elections Division are. We oversee the conduct of elections in Oregon, including serving as the filing officer for all state candidates. We investigate complaints about elections law violations dealing with the conduct of elections. We monitor compliance with state campaign finance laws and take enforcement actions where necessary. We administer the initiative referendum and recall process in Oregon, including oversight of the signature verification process. We publish and distribute statewide voters' pamphlets before each statewide election. We conduct training sessions for candidates, treasurers, county clerks, and city recorders on various aspects of elections law and how to comply with it. And our newest duty will be to implement the new federal mandates for elections under the new Help America Vote Act of 2002, which was adopted by Congress last fall and signed by the President. In terms of performance measures, because all of our activities are mandated by law, the division evaluates its performance by the success of the election process. This was a difficult year for the Elections Division. With fewer resources than in the previous biennium, the division successfully administered 4 statewide elections in 9 months. And we're getting inquiries already about having another statewide election in May, which will make it 5 statewide elections in a year. And I have to tell you, folks, I don't know of any other state that could pull that off, 5 statewide elections in a year. And I think that is a testimony to how much easier it is to ramp up to do an election in an all-vote-by-mail state than it is in a polling place state. There's just no doubt about that. Were all our statutory deadlines been met for all those elections? Yes. Were there any changes required in the certified ballot that required reprinting of ballots at state expense? No. Were the voters' pamphlets, 5 volumes over 4 elections, published and distributed on schedule, virtually error-free? Yes, outside of one embarrassing error that received substantial publicity. We did overall publish those voters' pamphlets on time. I'm sorry?
Mr. Chairman, we call the air.
Oh, you don't? Oh. You're going to make me talk about it?
If he wasn't, I was.
get your tie out.
In
a measure argument in one of the voters' pamphlets submitted by the Center for Public Policy, Center for Pubic Policy.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Oops.
Yeah. We had to live with that for a while. Were special statewide elections accomplished uniformly and timely? Yes, they were. Were the division activities result in judicial action? Is the division upheld, i.e. signature verification challenges, voters' pamphlet challenges, ballot access challenges? Yes, the division was upheld. Were division enforcement actions upheld? In other words, criminal convictions, civil hearings officer findings, etc. Yes, we were upheld. And are voters successfully registered? Yes, voters are successfully registered in Oregon. Budget issues. Most of our significant budget drivers for the elections division, such as the number of candidate filings and the number of CNE filings, have remained consistent or increased with past biennials. The number of election law complaints filed with our office, however, jumped from 634 in the 1999-2000 biennium to 888 in the current biennium. In general, it is fair to say that many citizens who file complaints with our office would like their complaints resolved faster. They want their complaints resolved before the election takes place. Most often, that is simply impossible given our current resources. The most significant budget issue for the next biennium is the large general fund reduction likely to be imposed in our division. The most logical place to impose the reduction is in the area of the voter's pamphlet, which would require raising fees in order to keep the pamphlet in its current form. There are a number of options available, and we have begun discussions with the Rules Committee chairs on various options to achieve savings by halting the large general fund subsidy of the voter's pamphlet.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Limbeck, I don't know whether the Secretary shared with you yesterday the question that I had raised about how the Secretary of State's office went about increasing fees for special district office holders in the county voters' pamphlets. And if you could go through that process, I've had some constituent issues raised that it was a process that occurred largely without notice, and that people who are seeking to put forward their credentials for election to non-remunerative offices are finding a filing fee of approaching $900 where there are multiple jurisdictions burdensome to the point that they are not wanting to run. Could you walk through that?
Right. And I'm glad to do that. I want to make a distinction here, though, that this is not a Division of Elections budget issue. This is a county budget issue because the fees at question here are paid to the county for county voters' pamphlets. Okay? So this adjustment in the fees that occurred last summer came about as a result of a request from county clerks who came to us and said, they wanted a couple of things, but one of the things that they wanted was for us to increase fees for candidates for these offices, for the voters' pamphlets, because their voters' pamphlets were getting so expensive that they were facing decisions last year about whether or not they could continue to print them. And so,
right, so that I understand, this was the Association of County Clerks?
Yes.
Or was it a group of clerks?
It came about as a result of a request that at an Association of County Clerks meeting, a general discussion among the clerks. Not all counties do voters' pamphlets. And frankly, it is in the state's interest, it's in all of our interest that they do. Because to the extent that they do, especially in the larger counties, they save the state money. Because in some of those larger places, if the county doesn't publish a voter's pamphlet, some of those candidates and measures qualify to be in the state voter's pamphlet. So we have a policy in the Secretary of State's office to try to encourage counties to do county voter's pamphlets.
And so when the clerks come to us with requests like that, we take it seriously. Marion County was in danger of losing its voter's pamphlet altogether. And Al Davidson, the clerk at Marion County, is one of the more articulate spokesmen on county voter's pamphlet financial issues. But they came to us last summer, asked for an increase in the fees, and we went about doing that in the normal process, which is to draw up a proposed rule, go out to public notice with the rule, and see if there's any public comment on it. And we got no public comment. Now, I know there's questions, because we have discussed this issue internally, Representative Johnson. I know there are questions about whether or not the notice is adequate, and we are looking at that to try and make a determination on that.
Perhaps what we could have you do, John, in that regard, rather than belaboring it here, would be to have you maybe visit with the special districts folks between today and tomorrow, and then particularly if you could with Hacienda Squires, and then get back with us with some sort of resolution with Ms. Squires, if you would, please.
Okay.
So that we can readdress this. Representative Johnson?
I just want to put a slightly finer point on it. The thing that I think is the largest concern to me is I've heard through the 2 days that the Secretary has been here your move to try to make the voter's pamphlet pay for itself. If that's going to be the case and fees are going to go up, I think we've got to figure out a mechanism to have constructive notice. You may have met legal notice, but I want to talk about really the adequacy of notice to inform folks that this is a possibility. This may have been a test run for trying to make the pamphlet self-sufficient, and I would submit to you maybe there were a couple of speed bumps.
Yeah, and we're looking at that to determine what they were and how serious they were. Despite the notice problems, that doesn't take away the budget, very real problems that county budget pamphlets face. Somebody has to pay the bill. And these district candidates, and I realize their argument that they are not paid for these positions. But the voter's pamphlet costs money, and somebody's got to pay for it. And the counties right now are paying for it, and they were making a very legitimate argument from what we could tell that they could no longer afford to pay for their voter's pamphlets at the fees that were being charged.
Senator Devlin?
I don't know if I cut off Representative Johnson. About three questions, actually. One is, in this discussion with special districts, which I know they won't like this discussion, is the obvious thing that comes up is if these special districts, you know, cross multiple county lines,
yes,
which is truly the case, particularly when you get to water and soil districts and everything else, is if they might bear some of the cost of that versus the counties, which will not be a pleasant discussion with them, but that's one of the realities of it in terms of getting people to run for these positions in the first place. They're not compensated, and they most often serve with very little public recognition of the good work that they do. So you'd think that the special districts might want to step up if they want to keep those candidates still listed in the voter's pamphlet, which may be, in the case of those candidates, may be the only way the public has to differentiate between who's running for the office and who isn't, or who the other candidates are. The second, more broader question, back to the budget side of the Secretary of State, in those discussions with the Rules Committee chairs, I would assume some of those previous discussions that have come up in other sessions are now looking more, more practical in the standpoint of, well, one, in terms of your measures, initiatives in terms of a statewide voter's pamphlet versus a county voter's pamphlet or county by county, and the potential discussion, which I know is controversial and maybe comment, about whether or not instead of, and this doesn't go to the fact of the measure side paying for itself, but goes to the side of lowering the cost. The discussion we've had previously in other sessions about whether there should be an argument in favor and an argument in opposition,
correct,
rather than 97 different arguments. Is that coming up in this?
Yeah, we're going to be, we're just starting down this process. We had an initial discussion with the rules chairs in which they asked us to come back to them with a plan
that I have dubbed "You Get What You Pay For." Okay. And this is holds true with particularly with respect to measure arguments. Right now, for $500, you get 325 words. We could impose fees, and we're talking about imposing fee increases anywhere from like 4 to 5 times, you know, as part of this discussion. If you impose a fee, you know, the $500 fee and make it $2,000, that's going to close a lot of people out of their ability to buy a measure argument. So what we would like to do, rather than just simply increase a fee for 325 words, is to keep a $500 option, but you're going to get exactly what you pay for, which is a lot less than 325 words. And that if you want 325 words, you'll pay more money. And so we're going to look at a sort of graduated or sliding scale as a possible solution on measure arguments. Because, frankly, when we get before legislative committees and we talk about increasing fees, we don't get a lot of testimony from people who get real upset about increasing the fees on candidates. Where we get people coming in protesting loudly mm-hmm. is increasing the fees on the measure arguments. And as Secretary Bradbury pointed out yesterday, for a statewide candidate, $1,000 to get into $1.6 million households is an extremely good value, and we could raise that 5 times, and it's still a good value. And I think that that's true with legislative candidates as well. Your $300 fee going up to $1,500 is still a very good value in your House districts or your Senate districts. And so that seems to sort of, at the start of this process, seem to draw less controversy, raising the fees on candidates. The sort of biggest political problem is when we get into the arena of what to do about measure arguments. And I think Senator Clarno in particular asked us to look at options where we would retain a $500 option, but you get exactly what you pay for with $500. And so that's sort of the approach we're taking. Now, in terms of cutting costs, we will, of course, be discussing the options on cutting costs as well and going back over some of those options. Those, I would expect we would have the same sort of reaction as we did last time when we trotted those out before committee is, you know, rebellion. People very unhappy with those kinds of options.
Mr. Chairman, the proposal to, it would not actually transfer the costs in terms of not being borne by the Secretary of State or by the general fund, but the proposal to simply limit it to an argument in favor and an argument in opposition, where the argument in favor would be by the proponents of the initiative, the chief petitioner, and that, and then the others would be selected probably by the Secretary of State from would indicate their interest in serving in an argument in favor committee, did have significant savings in it. Obviously, it would still keep it all as a public cost, but it would be much smaller pamphlet and probably much easier to prepare. And if you had, and if you're doing it statewide rather than doing, you know, keeping it separate from the candidates, the cost could be considerably less. On the candidate side, though, there are going to be discussions about some ways to potentially make that less expensive. And I don't know if there are ways to make it less expensive in the sense of we break up candidates by county, and maybe there's some larger divisions we could make it up. And I don't know if that would lead to all of I hate to say this, Mr. Chairman. I think from a candidate's standpoint and what I pay for printing, and as a Senate candidate, I pay considerably less per piece than I paid as a House candidate in terms of the actual, maybe not when you put all the consultants' fees into that, but in terms of the actual printing costs, I paid less. And congressional candidates and statewide candidates pay far less per piece, and so it seems to me the more pieces that you ultimately are able to print without having to distinguish between this county and that county and this county could reduce your cost too. I don't think we did this, but I know some states have actually tried to have their legislative House and Senate districts all fall within certain congressional districts, and I know we didn't do that, but I mean, if we had done that, that would have made it so that you could have basically published 5 pamphlets. It wouldn't really be that large if you were considering legislative and, you know, candidates and statewide candidates.
The number of volumes that we publish is no doubt I should say not volumes, but editions. I think we had 19 for the general primary and general elections, 19 different editions going out to the various parts of the state. That is also one of the issues that makes it very difficult. When people ask us for a per-page cost, it makes it very difficult for us to do that. In fact, impossible, because the per-page cost out in Baker County would be very different from what the per-page cost is in Multnomah County, based on the size of the booklet and how many people it goes to and all that kind of thing. I do have some voters pamphlet statistics here that that you might find interesting that I thought I would give the committee today, because this would be an important part of the discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I had one other follow-up.
Yes, please follow up, Senator.
Mr. Krishmack, I apologize for bringing this up during your presentation, but I wanted the committee to be aware of this. And it, could you comment? And I don't know where it's going to be contained in the budget. I don't know if it's going to be in a separate bill. I don't know where it's going to be. But we owe somewhere between $1 million and $1.5 million to counties for the January election.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, that election was not paid for, and it's made the county clerks very nervous. Jean Strait has a letter for you today, and she's going to talk about it in her presentation. We do have estimates from the counties on the cost of that election, and as part of our overall budget presentation, we'll be briefing you on that.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so let me walk you through this voters pamphlet statistics. This goes back, this concentrates on general and primary elections. As you can see, for the 2002 general in the far right column, an example of the kind of situation that we're talking about, the production costs down there in the second row from the bottom were $429,870. The postage was $324,271. The total revenue was $227,634. And so we're talking about revenues coming in at approximately 20 to 25% of the cost in most general fund, most general and primary elections. And that is the crux of the problem. We're subsidizing with the general fund very heavily these substantial booklets. And so that's the discussion that we're taking up with the rules chairs. And we have a bill, Senate Bill 139, before Senate Rules, in which the way the bill was originally written was to double the fees. But we asked the rules committees, please hang on to this bill. We'd like to have discussions with you about how to really make this work, because obviously to take the kind of reduction that our office is targeted to take under the measure 28 for the next biennium, we can no longer afford a general fund subsidy of the voters pamphlet of that size. If we don't do that, let's say that we just kept things the way we are and we took that targeted reduction, we would have no choice but to stop enforcing elections law in some other area. We would have to either stop oversight of our conduct of elections. We would have to stop our enforcement of campaign finance laws, or stop our oversight and enforcement of the initiative and referendum process. And obviously, when we look at that, that seems impossible. All of those things are the very foundation of Oregon's electoral system. If you look at our budget, the only place to turn is the voters pamphlet. The last point I want to make with you, or one of the last points, we have one more budget issue, and I referred to it earlier, and that's federal election reform. The Help America Vote Act of 2002 was adopted by Congress and signed by the President and places more responsibilities for elections on states. And some requirements are mandated, such as centralized voter registration, the elimination of punch cards, accessible voting equipment for voters with disabilities, and clear information for voters on the voting process. Federal funds will be coming our way to help us do this. The Congress just passed a budget bill that includes enough federal funding in it. It looks like Oregon may qualify, and just in the funding in that bill, for up to $17 million in federal funds to improve our election system. That's very exciting but daunting to look ahead to that process. Under the bill, we are required to do a state elections plan. We are working currently with county clerks, with stakeholders in the process, groups with an interest in voting, and with legislators, because we have four different legislators on our steering committee, on a steering committee that is guiding our development of a state elections plan. And we have to do the plan under the federal law. We can't get away without doing it. And, you know, what a concept to have a state elections plan. I was at a meeting of the National Association of State Elections Directors, and the congressional staffers were up there talking about this process, and they said, okay, everybody, just dust off your old plans. And we all looked at each other and laughed because, this has not been done. People actually doing state election plans where you get some sort of document that tells you what you want your election system to look like in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years. And that's what we're working on now, and it's a pretty exciting project. But really, the focus of it is how to meet the mandates of this law, because the mandates of this law are imposed on us regardless of whether or not the federal government came up with a dime for us. And so if we would have to do centralized voter registration regardless of whether or not the federal government helped us pay for it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand what you just said. You'd have to do it to exercise the response to the mandates, whether or not they came up with a dime. The good news is they've come up with lots of dimes.
Yes.
What all do we have to do in order to preserve our access to that money and not get stuck with the mandates with no federal money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for that question, because that was my next point. I want to talk to you briefly about House Bill 2145, which is currently before Ways and Means. House Bill 2145 is what we call the fast-track bill for compliance with the Help America Vote Act. And the first, there are two very important things in that bill that we have to do before we can accept money, and some of this money could be coming to us as early as the next 60 days. And the two things that we have to do is we have to create a state elections fund. And the federal bill requires that any money that goes into the fund and the interest earned on that fund has to go back into the state elections fund. And that's why we need legislation on this, because as I understand it, this is very different from other funds in Oregon state government. The other thing we have to do is we have to provide an administrative complaint process. And the authorization to do that is in this bill. And that is a provision that was put in the bill to help avoid lawsuits against the states associated with this legislation. And the administrative complaint process will be specifically designed as a state-based process in which people can file complaints with us about whether or not the state of Oregon and the counties are acting in compliance with the bill. And those are the two things that we have to do, and we will need a relatively swift action on this bill, because the funding bill was adopted the other day, and some of this money could be coming fairly quickly. And I'd just as soon have it in an Oregon state elections fund earning interest here than sitting in a federal account somewhere.
And maybe out of our reach.
Yeah. One of the questions, this bill went through House rules, and one of the questions that came up was about legislative oversight of the decisions made on how the federal money will be spent. They put two paragraphs in the bill, or two sections in the bill, dealing with the limitations on spending of that money for the current biennium and the next biennium. They left them blank, and our presumption is that Ways and Means would fill those in, and we will be coming to you shortly when this bill gets heard with dollar figures to put in those blanks and information for you on the proposals on how that money would be spent. So we welcome legislative oversight. We welcome reporting to the legislature on this funding. We're looking forward to working with you on it. This is a very exciting project, and it provides opportunities for Oregon elections that I think would never have happened if it weren't for this legislation and the money.
Thank you very much, John. Further questions? Are you finished with your presentation? You still have some.
I was asked to talk about our. We have one program option package, and then we had a couple of budget notes, and I was asked to be prepared to talk about those.
Why don't you go ahead and take the time? We are over time, but please do that.
Okay. We have one program option package. It's package 161. And that would add an investigator position to the Elections Division. This request stems from numerous complaints we received in the last election cycle regarding...
May I be excused?
Numerous complaints we received regarding petition signature fraud by paid petition circulators. And I don't know if any of you remember the controversy in the last cycle, but it was pretty intense and very difficult. Frankly, our division is systemically incapable of handling these complaints expeditiously enough to satisfy those who file the complaints. An in-house investigator would allow the Elections Division to handle investigatory duties that we now hand over to investigators at the Department of Justice. Our investigations must compete over there with criminal investigations of other types for investigator time, and this contributes to a delay in our cases getting resolved and dissatisfied citizens. We had two budget notes. The first one was that the subcommittee from the last biennium requested that we work with affected parties, including county clerks, to review our C&E forms and directives with the express purpose of making them easier to understand and complete. The Elections Division wrote each political committee in the state and county elections official immediately following the 2001 regular session, requesting suggestions for improvements. The staff also reviewed the reporting forms and instructions of the FEC and two dozen other states for comparison. The response received was principally to the effect that the forms are much improved over 1996, but generally Oregon has simpler and fewer forms than other jurisdictions. Suggestions for minor adjustments were received, and the division incorporated some of these in its revision of the 2002 campaign finance manual. Criteria for adopting the suggestions were, does the problem addressed have a general application by a significant number of committees, warranting a change / addition to the forms, or is it more an isolated transaction-specific issue that can be dealt with in the context of a single committee's reports? Does a suggested change make the reports of specific form more readable and transparent to the public? And if the suggested change adds reporting requirements for committee treasurers, does the additional information have significant meaning to the public to warrant the new requirement? If the answer was yes, the change was adopted to all three of those criteria. The division has concluded that the most effective means of significantly improving the ease of complying with the campaign finance reporting statutes is the creation of a web-based electronic filing program pre-programmed to guide treasurers through the reporting requirements with drop-down quick-pick menus, automatic deadline reminders, and error messages relating to specific entries. Creation of this program is contained in SOS POP 172, which will be discussed by Scott Smith, our Director of Information Services. And Senator Devlin, I think you might be familiar with that proposal. We tried it out before the House Rules Committee last biennium. We also called it easy filing. Our other budget note was the Secretary of State was directed to report to the 2003 Assembly on fines and penalties assessed and waived for violations of C&E filing requirements and the standards and criteria applied for those waivers. As of January 24, 2003, we had opened 713 state and local late cases in the current biennium. Of those, 254 have resulted to date in the violation being found. Of those, 134 had penalties waived because their fines were $50 or less. Five penalties were waived because the committee demonstrated one of the mitigating circumstances provided for in administrative rule. And a total of $41,551.58 has been assessed in late penalties to date in the current biennium.
How much of that's been collected?
I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Some of those committees no longer exist.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Bring it out of them?
Well, if we just can't find anybody, we have to write it off, I presume. But I'll double check.
We'll be able to find a candidate, obviously.
Yes. Sometimes candidates move. But we have one particular employee who's chased down candidates and out of state and actually found them and gotten them to
do that.
Okay. Yeah. As of January 24th, 2003, the Elections Division opened 181 state and local insufficient filing cases, including new transactions in the current biennium. Of those, 156 have resulted to date in a violation being found. Of those, 101 had penalties waived because their fines were $50 or less. One penalty was waived because the committee demonstrated one of the mitigating circumstances provided for in rule. And a total of $13,816.24 has been assessed in insufficient and new transaction penalties to date in the current biennium.
I'd like to have an update on how you're doing collection on those.
Okay.
With all of that, let's not go there right now. We'll come back to that. Senator Devlin, questions?
Not really, Mr. Chairman. Only just the one thing about the investigator position. There have been some lengthy discussions in previous rules committees. Since the sensitive subject area is that most of the things that the Secretary of State does relative to elections in terms of violations are just clear. You either filed the report, you didn't file the report. It was either on time or it wasn't on time. You either had the number accurately or you didn't. So intent was never really an issue. And the Secretary of State no Secretary of State has ever wanted to open up the issue of intent, because once you open up the issue of intent, then it becomes an extremely difficult thing to enforce. But this thing on signature gatherers and the complexities of this starts to open up some of those issues, because it isn't that clear, basically where a violation has occurred. It's not as clear a line. And so I can see why, as they get more of these complaints, that they're going to have to actually change at least that area of operation, because while most things, and I mean some of us, don't always like these things. That you either filed on time or you didn't, I think most of us have been through the process and sat on the committees a long time, understand clearly why the Secretary of State can't get into the issue in terms of filings and things on intent. It's either you complied with the law or you didn't comply with the law. But in this area, it gets to be a very gray area.
And I appreciate that. Coming back to the candidate issue, though, rather than just report on the collection activities, I'd like to know about the timeliness of those assessments and relationship. I had a case, some folks talked to me the other day about, I think it was 5 or 6 months later, that there was an issue that said, wait a minute, this particular report wasn't filed on time, or there was an error. No intent was ever alleged, no malice aforethought. But 5 months later, and particularly if you got a candidate who didn't prevail in their election, they look at that and say, well, I may be of a different political persuasion than the Secretary of State's office and the Audit Elections Division. So I think those are the kinds of things that I'd like to know how long it's taking to get these folks notified that there is a deficiency or a problem in relationship to after they close their campaign down. Okay, with that, we are substantially out of time. Tomorrow, let's go ahead and plan to finish up the rest of the Secretary of State's office with regard to the information systems folks are going to be here. We do want to come back and really go over the performance measures issues, particularly with regard to the statutory mission and mission statements of the various divisions, as well as the core services and then agency or division goals, and then take a look at the priority lists. And I don't know how much coordination there has been, Mr. Secretary, with your office relative to the priorities list that the co-chairs have asked for of the services that are mandated by your department, with regard to these 10% efficiencies lists, House Bill 3182, I think they call that, and then the 30% reductions list. And again, if you need more information about that, or your staff does, as they prepare those for us for tomorrow, again, we're not going into work session, but it will be, I'd like to get those priorities list, efficiency list, reduction list as a part and parcel of our overall hearing information so that we've got that in the record. With that, if we can go ahead, are there other questions, Mr. Secretary? I'm sorry to just unload that, but we can visit with that with you on that after.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, can Gene be in touch with the staff to
you
make
bet.
Sure we have
you
it,
bet.
We understand exactly what you want to hear from us about tomorrow?
You bet. That'd be fine. These are the same kinds of things that we're asking all agencies for, and this probably isn't any secret, and we're just running on a subcommittee to subcommittee, and we don't have rules anyway, other than just to be able to hear a batch of bills. But because general government and because public safety are two of the major places where general funds are expended, certainly not by a long shot the biggest spot, but the most numbers of agencies that are coming forward. We recognize that education and at all levels and the human services of the state use far and away the largest portion of those general funds, but they're asking us to find a minimum of 4% plus 3% ending balance of general fund efficiencies, and that's based upon the December forecast. My concern is that if we're down another 3%+ by the time we get to the May forecast, that the 4% efficiencies that the co-chairs have asked us for are going to be compounded to an additional 4. So I've asked them if they're really not talking about an 8% efficiency, which the 10% efficiencies list becomes very important, if we're looking for an 8% efficiency and a 3% ending balance, which would be 11%. And the indication has come back to me that probably isn't far off from where we're going to need to be because of the other demands that are going to be extracted from us back over into the health and human services and the educational needs of the state. So it's time that we all start looking at those kinds of things, and I hate to be the bearer of those bad tidings, but that's kind of where we're at. And again, the co-chairs have responded to my inquiry, is it 8% plus 3%, or is it 4% plus 3%? They're saying those agencies that large number of agencies that are generally funded, and the general government and public safety, you probably ought to start looking for 8 plus 3. So we're gonna go on that hunt and maybe get a good start on just those efficiencies and the reductions list, as well as the priorities. I took to identify the missions tomorrow. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow evening time. Thank you very much.